You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops. But over time...
And I want to welcome to the stage Allison Forgale. So Allison is the Mary Farley Ames Lee Distinguished Scholar of Organizational Behavior at the Kenan Flagler Business School at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. This new book is incredible, and she knows that I'm not just making that up. I love this book. I actually had her give me three advanced copies that I could hand out to our management team because it was that good. It's called Likeable Badass, How Women Get the Success They Deserve. Allison, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Am I on?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for having me here. But before, I know we're going to talk a lot about Likeable Badass, and we're going to talk about things I have to say, but we have to acknowledge first that it is Kelly's birthday. And so when we scheduled this, he said, on my birthday. So I can't think of anything you would like to do more, Kelly, than talk to me on your birthday. So he's such a great friend and great supporter, and even so much that he would do it on his birthday. So.
I am actually happy to do this on my birthday.
I won't make everyone say happy birthday.
No, you don't have to sing happy birthday. So in the first chapter of your book, you quote a LinkedIn post from a digital health strategist. Her name was Lauren Howard, who says, women really only want three things. One, equal pay. Two, respect. Three, pockets. Is that the right order?
Well, obviously not, because pockets, comfortable shoes, all those things deserve to be at the top of the list. But what I loved it when I saw it, because it rang true in a very humorous way. But I also thought it was very telling that equal pay and respect, which are two things that are central to this book, the order is the order that you would predict, right? That the idea of, yes, respect and regard are nice to have, but they don't pay the bills. So if I can only have one thing, I'm going to go with pay, I'm going to go with advancement. And I get that logic, but what I talk about in the book is that that logic is flawed in a way, because respect, which is what we talk about as status, is really central to our ability to do all kinds of things, live a good life and get paid and promoted the way we should be.
Do you want to tell people how we met?
I would love to tell people how we met. So, and you'll fill in detail. So we met in a virtual book authors group that I was invited to, organized by a professor from Yale who had very generously started it when she was writing her own book and going through her journey. And we met in the group, and everyone's virtual. I don't know who anybody necessarily is, but I see Kelly, and you either said something about Second City, and maybe that was how I first came to know you and your work. And at Second City, I live walking distance from Second City. So I reached out to Kelly, and I said, you don't know me, but I'm at Hollywood Square in the Zoom room, and I live right up the street. And so we
had, like, lunch or something.
We had lunch, yeah.
And one of the things that I got interested in when I found out that Allison's work was this field, and a lot in the area of status, which is, in comedy, status is huge. So if you know anything about old-time comedy duos, it's all high-status person, low-status person. And it's the subversion of the status often that is where the comedy comes from. And I'm married to every parent's nightmare. My wife has a comedy major that you can go to. So she is a tenured professor of comedy. And so we instantly got into this thing. And this book is so interesting in terms of what you talk about with regard to power and status. And I think most people would default to say that power is more important than status.
I think that's right, and partially because that's the only narrative they have. I mean, many people might be wondering, what is this status thing you're even talking about? And the story I like to tell is that the original title of this book was supposed to be Likeable Badass, How Women Win the Status Game. And the editor who bought the book said, great, except we can't use that subtitle. Why? She said, because no one knows what status is, which is why you have to write the book, but then you can't put things that people don't know what they are on the book. It's very bad for selling books. I said, okay. So we didn't do it. And so I think it's partially because we haven't been talking about it. We kind of know it exists out there, but it hasn't really been labeled in a clear way, and that was part of what I was trying to do here, was to put a name to a phenomenon that we can see and then start to recognize it in the world and think about how we can act on it.
So let's talk about how this plays out, though, like in an office setting, because when I think about, one of the things you talk about in the book is that's important to understand about status is other people give it to you.
Correct. So status is the way psychologists will talk about it. And if you look in the dictionary definition, this is one of them. It's there. Is status is the respect and regard that other people have for you. So what that means is, by definition, your status exists only in someone else's mind. You cannot take it. It can only be given. And so it's incredibly important for our quality of life, our life satisfaction, our ability to get power and to use it well, all of these things, but it exists only in other people's heads. And it does then make it feel like, well, that's hard to control. Like, now I have to control what other people think. And we don't, at the end of the day, have perfect control over that, but we do have a lot of influence over it, because those judgments about how much people respect us, they're not random. There is a science to it, which is, we can talk about the title of the book, but it really talks about the science of how people make those judgments.
And the thing is, I mean, we all know people who have power but zero status. And we know plenty of people, at least I do, who have no power and tons of status. And I think about, like, that person, there's always a person on staff who kind of knows where everything is and knows who everyone is, and that you sidle up to that person. You're very smart if you do that.
100%. Right. So that was one of the things that I started being really curious about. So power is controlling resources that people value, whether it's, you know, you have a teenager and you have the car keys, or you can hire and fire or give someone the good review or the bad review. And a lot, sometimes those things go hand in hand. We respect the people that have all the control, but sometimes they don't. So there's the person who controls nothing, but they know everything and everyone values their opinion. They're very tied in, you know, to the network. And then there is the other one, which you talked about, is the person who has a lot of power, but isn't very highly regarded. And I have spent a lot of time studying that category, and it's a miserable category to be in. Mm-hmm. I mean, because no one likes a low status power holder. That's the quickest way to be mistreated or poorly treated, is to have a lot of control but not be highly regarded. And that makes me particularly nervous for a lot of people, but women included, because gender is what we call an ascribed status characteristic. You don't control it, and it has no meaning necessarily, but we've given it meaning, and so therefore we've decided that certain groups get less respect than other groups. And so I am particularly always worried that women are one category of people who are more likely to end up in the low status power holder. And oftentimes when I say that to women, they're like, oh, you've just described my last job and why I left.
Mm-hmm. All right, so what are the qualities that make a likable badass?
So I get questions on this. Likeable badass, that it refers to the two dimensions that are the basis of status. So when you look at another person and you think, oh, I think about that person in your non-conscious brain, and you're deciding, do I respect that person or not? That's not a random judgment. It's based on assessing two things. So like a y-axis and an x-axis. And the y-axis is going to be what I call our assertiveness. That's, are we capable? Are we confident? Are we competent? If I give you a task, can you get it done? And the x-axis is going to be our warmth. Do you care about people other than yourself? Are you likable, but also are you honest, sincere, giving, helpful, all of those things? And so likable badass is my catchy term for warmth and assertiveness. And again, I would have called it the interpersonal circumflex of person perception, but they also said that was a bad title, so I went with,
and they were correct.
Yeah, I went with likable badass. So that's what it comes from. It comes from doing the two things that are the surefire way to get another person's brain to see you as a person of value.
This is hugely important in my mind, because you have to be both, right?
You do.
Because they're and talk about the negatives for each, right? If you're just warm but not assertive, are people seeing?
That's right. So the, one of the really important things to remember is that these are two dimensions, not one. We often talk about them as if there's a trade-off. And if you hear people, you would think if I were drawing a picture, it would be one dimension, warms on one end and assertives on the other. And particularly for women, I understand why they talk about it that way, because they feel like a trade-off has to be made. But if you think about it as two dimensions, you can be warm and assertive. That's going to be likable badass territory. But you could also be warm and submissive. So that's actually, if you're not going to be likable badass territory, warm and submissive is your second best choice in terms of the second best place to be. Because those people, we don't see them as very confident or capable, but we really like them a lot, so they're kind of harmless. The other quadrant is I'm really assertive, but I'm very cold, seen as very concerned about the self and self-interested. And that's where we start to get into, particularly for women, this idea of being aggressive, being hostile, all of those things. And that's problematic as well. And then there is something worse than that, just in case you always thought that was the worst it could get. I mean, you could be cold and submissive, which is actually worse because you're neither of the two things. People don't end up in that situation all that much. But in case you ever been put into the aggressive and thought it couldn't get worse, it could, I guess. You could be cold and submissive.
And it's also, it's not stat, it's not, it's fluid, right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, so these are not quadrants that you end up in and you stay. I mean, in any given moment, your status can change, your relationship change. So you can go into one room, into one audience that values you in a particular way and sees you in a way, and you can go into a different room. And then you can show up differently. So 100%, this space is just a space that we all navigate and a space that our brains pay attention to when we're trying to figure out, what do I think about this person?
There's a ton of myth-busting in the book, and I want to talk a bit about that too. And one of the things you talk about is the phrases like, you shouldn't care what people think about you, which I know sounds maybe appropriate, but actually you do need to care what people think about you.
Yeah, I always say it is like the worst advice our parents ever gave us, and my kids are here, and so sorry if I ever said that. It's actually just really not a good thing to say. I understand why you say it. It's always said out of love in a moment of saying, I'm not getting what I want from other people. It feels really painful. It feels hard to control, and I get that. At the same time, when we condition people to turn away from their audience when they're not getting what they want, we are setting them up to not be able to manage status, which again exists in their audience's mind, very effectively. And so for, you know, all the parents out there thinking about like, well, what else could I say, you know, other than that, I always say, think about something that's equally kind but makes people understand how these decisions happen. To say something like, you know, it's really hurtful when people don't see how great you really are, and that's painful, but you have, you know, great qualities, and if you keep showing up that way, I guarantee people will eventually come to see them, or something like that. But we do that, I think, to keep people from pain, and it sends an incorrect message and gets them to turn inward rather than what psychologists know we should be doing, which is turning outward to our audience.
Well, because at the end of the day, I mean, it is all about our relationships, like everything. And there, you know, the famous study in Harvard that they're doing now with the men who are about to, they're in their 80s, I think, now. Uh-huh. Where they found the key to happiness over time was our relationships. And I think that doesn't just, that's all of life. You know, the division between, I always find it funny that we draw this line at work when we walk in the door as if somehow that's a different life, when it's actually the same thing. So office politics, like, you gotta actually play some level of office politics.
Yeah, I mean, that's another phrase or a phrase I think gets a negative valence to it. But when I say it, all it is, you know, being able to understand the network, to being able to have influence. And that's neither good nor bad. You could do good or bad things with it. I think people think about it. A lot of times when we think about being effective at working through other people, we think about some of the negative ways in which we've seen that happen. And then it causes us to abandon the entire idea. So, one of the things I talk about in the book, which is not my analogy, but I think it's so brilliant, is Bob Cialdini, who's the well-renowned psychologist who's done a lot of work in influence, made this distinction between bunglers, smugglers, and sleuths. Because as a person who taught people how to be influential, he'd get a question, are you teaching people to manipulate other people? People don't want to be manipulative, so then they shy away from office politics or navigating relationships. They said, no, there's three kinds of people in the world. You have bunglers. Those are people who want to be influential, but they're terrible, so they can't get anybody to do anything. You have smugglers who are using poor means to achieve their ends. But then you have sleuths, and sleuths are people who want to be influential for things they really believe in, are trying to do good things, and they're effective at understanding how to influence people. So, you know, parenting examples, but I would say you want a kid to eat more vegetables. That could be a good end, and you'd say, well, there's certain influential things I can do to be able to make that happen. And so thinking about it as sleuthing rather than smuggling is something that I really want for people, and particularly women, to say, this is a thing we all need to do to be able to exchange value and live fully through our relationships. And if you do it with authenticity and strategy, then you can achieve good ends and be able to be a sleuth.
I did a sleuthing thing with the kids on vegetables.
Okay.
So when they were very little, we would say, if you eat the yellow peppers, your eyesight will get better. And then I'd go to like one side of the room, I'd hold up a finger and ask my wife how many fingers I was holding up, and she'd get it wrong. And then my son would get it right. And then eat more yellow peppers. So that's...
See, right?
Yeah.
Good ends, right?
Yeah, it worked.
100%.
So Jack mentioned that we do corporate work here, which is a big part of our business. And what we do is we come and do these improv exercises a lot with different companies that allow them to sort of model behaviors and just things like decision-making, collaboration, and all that. We are playing games. But if we call it playing games, no one is going to pay us the money that they pay us for what we do. And what I really appreciated in your book is you talk about this idea of games, but you have to also qualify it, because you know that people are going to be like, well, you can't say it's a game. But I just had Kelly Clancy, a neuroscientist, on the podcast, who talked about the importance of games and that really they present a model of the world. So when we're young, we are playing games and we're learning how to negotiate and how to manage people and all that. And we're really doing that as we get older, too. So can you talk a little bit about what you thought of when you started using that term?
Yeah, so I was really struck by, and you might know this from all this work, turns out there's not a single definition of what the definition of a game is.
Yeah, no.
There's some debate about it. And so I was really struck by this one definition that was offered, which is a game is a problem-solving activity approached with a playful attitude. And again, people might dispute whether that's a definition, but I thought that really fits a lot of things that I'm trying to help people do. So I said, you know, getting into college is a game, asking someone on a date is a game, Monopoly is a game, but managing your status can also be a game, which is, it's a problem to solve, but it can be done with some joy and authenticity and playfulness that doesn't have to make it painful to have to fix. And I really like that idea. I also like the game analogy because I say games aren't always fair. Sometimes you get bad things that happen to you, you know? A ref makes a bad call, you lose a turn, whatever it is, and you have to navigate that. And I think that for women and trying to advise women, I always say, you've been handed an unfair game, but that doesn't mean that you can't, again, approach it with a playful attitude and even win and think about how to do it like that. And so that really struck me. I thought the analogy was really apt for thinking about this. And, you know, I say just, you know, because I coach people to play the best game that I can doesn't necessarily mean that I'm endorsing the rules.
We have a phrase in our work that you need to replace blame with curiosity. And I really like to gamify my interactions with difficult people. I find that it's like, how can I turn this? Is there a way for me to turn this situation? Because clearly this person is either coming in hot or something else happened or they're mad about whatever. But if I can gamify it, I find I have better odds of walking away from those interactions in a more positive manner.
100%. I say something similar in a different way, which is behavior is always data. That you don't wake up deciding, you know what I'm going to do today? Be as mean to as many people as I can. Right? Now, that doesn't mean you don't snap, you aren't stressed, you don't say something that you would wish you could take back. We all have moments where we're not, you know, proud of how we showed up. But that was never our intention when we woke up that day. And I think Dan Pink, I don't know if you were in the meeting when Dan Pink, who's a well-known author, came, and he said, stop thinking you're so unique. When people, and he said it to authors in your writing. If you think it's interesting, other people will too. But it applies to this. If you are only difficult when the circumstances permit, right? Other people are too. And so behavior is always data. And I think rather than take it as simply a disposition to say, gamify it or get curious about it, is what's the thing that led that to happen? Because it's not the idea that somebody woke up and decided they're just going to make your life hard.
Dan Pink, two things. One is he gave Kim Scott the title for Radical Candor.
He did?
Yep. That was his idea.
That's amazing. I did not know that.
Yep. And then he also gave this. This is how I close almost all my keynotes, is a phrase, a little saying that he gave me, which is, you need to fight like you're right, but listen like you're wrong.
Awesome.
That's good,
he's
right?
He's great. Yeah. If people don't follow him, even on LinkedIn, he has his Wednesday Wisdom.
Oh, yeah. He's great. Dan's terrific.
Yeah.
His biggest book is what? To Sell Us...
There's Regret. There's To Sell Us Human, Drive.
Yeah. A bunch of good stuff.
Yeah. They're all good.
You have a quote in the book, quote, the faster we talk, the more status we get.
That's true. So, and I, one of the things I chase as a psychologist, I try to be very evidence-based, and there's definitely, an idea of the person who talks the most and says nothing in the meeting and then ends up emerging as the leader. It's annoying, but it's actually has a lot of support for it. So what happens is how capable you are, how other-oriented you are, these are things that are hard for us to observe. So we're looking for signals. And so the faster we talk, the quicker we enter the conversation, so the shorter our pauses, the more direct our speech, all of these things are clues about what's this person going to be like, what are their contributions going to be like. And when you talk faster, you actually get to make more contributions in a smaller amount of time. So there is some truth to it. I'm not advocating for it and saying, oh, I went to this podcast and what I learned was I should go into a meeting and say nothing as quickly as possible. Not that. But so the more we talk, the faster we talk, all of those things are taken as cues. And although that stuff can be really frustrating, I actually see great power in it, because what it means is that the way you show up has a tremendous impact to affect how your audience sees you. And if you can start to then get curious about, okay, well, what's the relationship between how I'm showing up and what results I'm getting? And if I don't like the results, how do I experiment with showing up in some other kind of way that might get me the results that I deserve?
And look, if you're gamifying the thing too, silence can be a status move. I don't know if I've ever told you this. My wife Anne was co-leading a exec ed class with Richard Thaler at the University of Chicago, and she did a status exercise where one person would have a conversation, the other person, just their job was to nod the whole time, and these very powerful men couldn't do it. They would not do it.
Could not.
Nope.
That's amazing.
Because they couldn't drop their status.
Huh.
Yeah. Interesting. Powerful speech versus powerless speech. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's what got me into this whole thing in the beginning. So 20-ish years ago when I was in graduate school, there were a lot of books that were oriented toward women that were practitioner books, but they would all be espousing the value of being more assertive and dropping anything that was associated with submission, like what we would talk about as powerless speech. You shouldn't hedge. You shouldn't end your sentences as questions. You shouldn't put disclaimers on everything. Everybody's heard these things before. And I got curious about that and said, well, is that actually correct? It seemed very simple advice that we're offering people. And so what I did at that time was I looked at you comparing both of them. And what you see is, yes, when you get more direct and you drop all of that filler stuff from your speech, you are seen as more assertive, but you're also seen as less warm, everything else being controlled. Powerless speech, you get the opposite. You're seen as less capable, more submissive, but you're seen as warmer and friendlier. And what I also looked at was, well, where does status come from? The no-fail surefire recipe is to show up as really capable and really caring, and that always works. But sometimes even one is good enough, and it depends on your environment, and that's what I was looking at. So when people need to work with you, they care a lot more about how warm you are because it's miserable otherwise. And so they start to prioritize that more. And what that means is someone who might have more tentative, more submissive patterns of behavior, like powerless speech, but signal that they're going to be really easy to work with, they actually get preferred, they get favored, they get the status, they get the power. So in that work, I was really thinking about two things. One, is there value in a behavior that half of the population has been told to never use again? And the answer is, yeah, there is value in it. It actually is a tool for showing up as very warm and friendly. Now, that may not be a tool you need, and so some people still might be advised to drop it if they could. But I think the other thing is that sometimes being warm is more important than being assertive for when it comes to people respecting you. And sometimes it's the opposite. But we have to be sensitive to our environment, because even though being both is going to be your best option, it may not always be weighted 50-50.
So smiling.
Yes.
Is a way of...
Now I'm going to try to do it.
You're going to try to smile?
I'm going to try to smile.
Yeah, you're smiling.
Okay.
I mean, you actually say you are not a good smiler.
No, so, okay, so I'll tell you the inside scoop on this part. But you were going to ask me a question.
You're going where I wanted you to go.
Yeah. Okay. So smiling, right? Smiling is a signal of warmth. But I am not good at it. And it takes a lot of conscious effort. And so for years, when I was a kid, when I was a graduate student, I would remember people saying to me, "What's wrong?" And I would be like, "What do you mean, what's wrong?" And they'd say, "You have that look on your face." Particularly if I'm thinking, which I have a very mean look on my face if I'm thinking. So if I'm in an audience, I'm listening to a talk, I look like the most unhappy audience member alive. And it would cause people a lot of angst. What was wrong? What did I say? What didn't you like? I liked everything. And so that was just how I was. And then years ago, I got an email from, and so this is the thing, I'm not going to say who, but I'm just going to say it's someone we both know very well. And if I were to name drop, I think 80 to 90% of this audience would also know well. I got an email from this person. There was no text in the message. There was no subject line. There was simply a New York Times article attached. And it was the article in which, as far as I can tell, the term resting bitch face was coined. And I'm like, why did this person send me this article with no subject and no text? And I was like, oh, that's me. I'm resting bitch face. So I'm not a good smiler. And so I talk about that in the book of, can we convey warmth through nonverbal behaviors? Absolutely. Is smiling a good one? Yes, it is. Would I like it if I were a better smiler? Sure. I'm just not. I'm going to be 49. I know that it's not happening. So I just go with, I don't need it. I've got something else. And so that's one of the things that I try to tell people to do is, yeah, there's things that you should experiment with and should practice with and see if you could get better at them. But if, like me, you've decided, I have this thing, that's not my thing, let it go.
Well, there's two things that you do in place of that, which is you're funny and you swear.
Both of those. I am hilarious.
You are funny. I think I'm qualified to...
You are certainly qualified. Yes. That means a lot. He has not said that to me before.
I haven't said that to you? No, you are funny.
Very complimented by that. I want to tell you, I didn't give it to you as your birthday card because it was too small, but I'm going to spoil it because I will give it to you at some point. It's sitting at home. But I have this little card that I have for you, and it says, I feel sorry for people who aren't us because we're hilarious.
Yeah.
And that I thought, I was like, Kelly needs that.
Well, yeah, no.
But humor has science behind it too, right? And when mm-hmm. I learned that, I thought, okay, I've got other things, right? Humor is affiliative, and humor is also considered, if it lands well, it's considered smart. It's a way to convey assertiveness. And so, yes, I do swear. I do swear.
You talk about this study that Jennifer Chapman and her colleagues did, and it was 15 years of teacher evaluations for male and female professors. This was a slightly upsetting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you ever read something and you're like, I just should quit my job. There's just no point.
Yeah.
Jenny Chapman's a brilliant professor out of Berkeley. Her and her co-authors did a great, again, depressing study. What they did was they looked at teacher evaluation, so people like me, university professors, and their student ratings that they get over a 15-year period, but within person, meaning they would look at my ratings, not, thank God I wasn't in this, but like my ratings from year one, year two, year three, so they could compare me to me. So what they found was that for a given professor, as that professor went through their life cycle, there was a different pattern for men and for women. And what they found was for the women professors, as they approached, let's say, mid-career, middle age, those professors' evaluations started to get worse than they were when they were younger, and that they would be again when they were older. That the middle age was the worst perceptions. That essentially what happened was they were seen as the low-status power holders. They were seen as very assertive and not very warm, particularly when they got to that mid-career point. And the male professors did not have any relationship like that. And they didn't talk about it in terms of power and status. They really were just talking about these perceptions. but and gender, but I really see it as a power and status thing, which is in our field, when are you the most powerful as an academic is kind of in middle age. And that's true of many careers too, right? Yeah. You come up the career and all of a sudden you run all the things and then you're on the glide path and you're like, I'm just, you know, cruising out of here. And so it was when people were at their peak, they were running all the things, they were the deans, they were in charge of things. You could see it reflected even in the way the students reacted to them as, okay, well, yeah, we see you as really capable and competent, but we don't like you anymore.
So this authors group that we're both involved in that Zoe Chant started, it's got some very cool people like Charles Duhigg and a person that you fangirled and I did too was Annie Duke.
Oh, yes.
So why don't you tell them about who Annie is and how she ended up in your book?
So I have been an Annie Duke fan since I was in graduate school, maybe late 90s, early 2000s, when the World Series of Poker had a moment on ESPN. And I love poker. I love gambling. I love all things Las Vegas. My husband's here. We got married in Las Vegas. I told him on my second date that I was going to get married in Las Vegas to him or anybody else, and that had to be, you know, he had to be okay with that. And this has nothing to do with anything. But he said, well, where are you from? And I said, I'm from Pittsburgh. He said, well, and he's from Chicago, born and raised in the city. He said, well, I've never really given it much thought, but I guess I just assumed if I got married that I would get married in wherever my wife was from. So if you're telling me my choice is Pittsburgh or Vegas, I'll take Vegas. That sounds great. But anyway, I come to watch a lot of poker. I see Annie Duke, professional poker player, very successful in the World Series tour. And then I knew that she had then become an author writing and speaking about decision-making under uncertainty, which is something that poker players have to do a lot. And then she retired from poker, and I go to the book group, and it wasn't my first meeting or second, but it might have been my third, and there is Annie in the square. And I have never been so starstruck, and I'm texting my husband at work, you are not going to believe who is in this book group. Annie Duke is in this book group. So I reach out to her a couple times, and I'm trying to play it cool, and I'm not playing it cool. I'm like, I really love you, you're amazing. And so I finally connect with her, and she is so spectacular. I mean, she is the most brilliant, benevolent person, very likable, badass personified. And every time we would be in these group meetings, she would say one brilliant thing after another. She'd offer to help people. I mean, in terms of like really a person who just was able to navigate status and claim all that she rightfully deserved, she was brilliant. And I reached out to her. I said, I'd like to talk to you about the book. And I told her the title. And you know, I got a lot of great advice from her about it. But one of the things I think that's telling that I do write about is she was a little bit resistant at first because she said she was thinking about her poker life. And she said, I'm not sure people in poker would see me that way. And what we really did is we talked about, we broke down, you know, how the status dynamics for her as a very successful woman in poker were not enough to really build her status. And when she went to these other audiences, particularly started speaking to audiences like this about how to use poker skills to be able to make better decisions, she said, everyone was so nice to me. They were just so much nicer. And I said, well, maybe they weren't just nicer people, but they were nicer to you because in that world, they saw your status really differently. That being a winning World Series of Poker player is a mark of you know, very high status, and you're giving all this advice on the behalf of on benefit of other people, and so you know that's how we came to meet. And she's been, you know, still such a great advocate. I can't say enough about the nice things she did. And then a young professor at UNC saw that I had posted about her, that I knew her, and wrote to me and said, I've been teaching Annie stuff in my class for years. Do you think there's any chance she would talk to me? And I said, I think there is. And and Annie, being Annie,
yep,
of course, was like on the phone with her the next day, recording an interview for her class. But yeah, so it was really interesting to talk about this idea that, to your point about environments, like in one environment, she felt very highly regarded. And in another environment, same her, as far as she saw it, she wasn't. And I talked about the idea that, again, as her status changed across those environments, so did people's treatment of her. And she said ultimately, it's like, I think some of the reasons she ended up retiring from poker.
It's amazing, too. I think that most people have the perception that people achieve a certain thing, and that must mean that you're totally fine and everything's great. And because I've worked with people, Tina Fey and other people like that, and Amy Poehler, and like those people have the same problems that we all have. They think they're frauds often. Renee Fleming, the greatest opera diva in the world, I've told this story before, that we worked on a project together and we've become friends, and she's saying, the national anthem at the Super Bowl. So I text her afterwards. I'm like, that was great. And immediately she calls me and goes, I think I was off. And I'm like, you were not. You're Renee Fleming. You were not off.
Well, I mean, and there's science to this too, right? Which is, it's just, that is the, that phenomenon is the exact same as when you watch the American Idol or the singing show, and the person who you cannot sing, but you look in their eyes and you think they don't know they can't sing, mm-hmm. right? They are 100%. They're not there for a joke. They are 100% there thinking they can sing, is because the people who lack confidence also lack that metacognition to understand good from bad. And people who are very good at what they do have the metacognition. They can pick up differences in their performance that, like, a dog wouldn't be able to hear, right?
Yeah.
And so they can do that, and that makes you actually feel in some ways like you're going backwards or you're worse, that the better you become, the more you're able to see the nuance in performance. And that's true in singing, but it's also true, I think, in status, too. As I try to tell people, is as you get better at this, sometimes you feel like you're getting worse, and you're not getting worse. You're just now able to see the differences you couldn't see before and see how the change in your behavior is affecting the reaction you're getting and feel like, oh, I really screwed that one up and I did the wrong thing. I say that's not the case. You're just getting better metacognition of being able to distinguish good from bad.
Okay, so we're going to come to the audience for questions in a second. So think of those, and Emma's out there, which will have her mic, so raise your hand in a moment. But the last thing I want to talk to you before we go to that, so we get hired at Second City a lot for storytelling. Mm-hmm. So they'll call and say, we want to hire you for storytelling. What I've learned over time is, be like, what do you mean? Do you mean sales? Do you mean presentation skills? Do you mean influence? And usually when you dig down, you figure out that it's something a little bit deeper. And what you talk about in this book is, not only is it important for you to know your story, but it's really important for other people to be able to tell your story as well.
Yeah, as I say, at the end of the day, everything that somebody knows about you comes from only one of two places. Information you've put out into the world in some way, shape, or form. They've heard you say it, they've read it about you online, whatever it is, and things that other people say about you. And we've been told for a long time that we need to control our own channel. So I think we can all do it better, and we can do a better job of gaining status through it. But that's not a new message. The piece I try to emphasize in the book is that other people tell our stories for us, right? So as an example, right? Kelly was really instrumental in introducing me to a variety of people who have been very helpful in this book, Kim Scott being one of them. And I was saying, you know, I'm a big fan of Kim Scott, but I didn't know Kim. And Kelly says, I know Kim. I will introduce you. And with kind words from Kelly, Kim is, I mean, she's just the world's nicest human being. But with kind words from Kelly, right, next thing you know, within 5 minutes, she sends me her cell phone number. And she says, call me. And I'm like, I can't actually call Kim Scott, can I? And I'm like, I'm just going to do it. And I just paced around my kitchen and I called her. But here's the thing. That was your other promotion of me, right? Mm-hmm. You opened the door. And that happens all the time. And when it happens, we're grateful for it. But what I try to help people think more strategically about is, how can you make it happen more often? Because it's so powerful. And it's such a great way that you can build your status. One, you don't have to say anything uncomfortable. And two, other people can be so much more effusive about you and talk about all the ways that you're amazing in ways that you never could. And so I try to help people think about that second channel, because I think we're all underutilizing. We know it's amazing when we get it, but it's not just happenstance. And we can start to get more systematic about bringing that and cultivating that in the world. And so I will give you, as we go to questions, one piece of advice, tip of goodness on that, is one way to make that happen is just start saying good things about other people. So every time you have something positive that you are thinking, put it out into the world. Tell somebody about it. Because the grapevine today is so efficient, and there's all the ways in which that's horribly problematic for the life that we live.
Yep.
But one other way it's great is that when you say something good about somebody, they're going to find out about it very quickly, and it comes back to you. And human behavior is reciprocated. So if we want other people to build our status for us, let's build theirs and talk about their great qualities. Talk about how giving they are. Say the positive things. And that, if nothing else, is going to be something strategic that comes back to us a million times.
Amen. All right, who's got a question? Right over here. Hold on. Wait. No, there was more than one. I saw you first. Here's the mic.
Hi. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's enlightening and amazing. So one of the things I find as being an assertive, warm person is that I'm not a leader and I'm not a follower. And so I find myself having the conversation of where I'm a very direct person, and then I find myself in situations where I'm trailblazing in conversations, and then I find that I can't find that warmth. And so I feel like I want to approach people in a way that I'm very confident, but I just can't seem to approach that room in the way that I want to. So I'm very confident in who I am. I'm 100% totally know exactly who I am and where and why I even came to this event. I want to be a likable badass. I just don't know, like, how do you take who you've become and where you came to this point and still find that point where you're like, oh, where did I lose my warmth somewhere in being a badass?
Okay, I can already tell you have not lost any warmth, right? You're a perfectly legit, likable badass. So we'll start there. Here's a couple thoughts. One is that I talk about the best, easiest time to build your status is when you don't need anything. So that means we have to play a long game. So if you're talking about situations where I'm walking into a room and I want something, and I'm also trying to like get you to like me at that point, and I'm trying to get my point across, it's a lot to do in one moment. So one thing you could think about doing is stepping back and thinking, what are the things that I can do to help build my warmth with a wide audience so that when I walk into that room, that has already been established for me, and so I don't have to build it right at that moment. But that requires us stepping back and starting to think about our relationships from day one, and thinking about all the different small, easy ways that we can add value and make other people's lives better so we can build it. So starting earlier, I think, is helpful. And the other thing I always advise people is I say add, don't subtract. So you are you, right? And that's your baseline. And so what I'm hearing you say is assertive comes a little easier to me. I'm good there. I can do that in my sleep. I'm looking for the ways to add the warmth. So I'd say, great, keep what you're doing, but then think about ways that you could do it, right? Where, helping other people. Right? Warm doesn't always have to be like smiley and nice and pastels, but it could be adding value to other people's lives. Thinking about things you really enjoy doing that can bring benefit to other people. Doing it in that moment, doing it before. If someone else makes a point, amplifying their point, complimenting it, saying that was a really great idea. All different kinds of things, and experiment until you find things that feel natural. And then I always say it's going to feel a little awkward at the beginning, otherwise it's not a good practice. But then like me, if you've done something for long enough, like smiling, and you're like, no, I'm going to ditch it. But I think those two things are things that are really helpful to start earlier, and then figure out your baseline and think about what you could sprinkle in.
So kind of talk about planning ahead before you get to it.
I think planning ahead just in life, because the reality is you never know who you're going to end up influencing or needing to talk to or being in a relationship with. You just know it's going to be somebody. So one of the things I think about is like spreading it around as widely as you can. Certainly if you work in an organization, starting with the people who work within the bounds of that organization, those are people you're likely to come into contact with. So I'll give you a specific way to, like, example. So a woman I talk about in the book, but she said she got a piece of advice from a very senior leader early in her career, and she said, figure out who here you need to rely on and figure out a way to make their life better twice a year. Right? Very specific. But the idea was, you know you're going to need people. Thinking about investing in those relationships in advance, make someone's life better is a great way to show up as warm. And if you start to have that mentality, and then she started to give examples of where she started to do that and made great allies and friends, but she's like, I would have never thought to do that if my boss didn't give me that specific task.
That's a good one. Another question over here.
Thank you, and I'm looking forward to reading the book. I think it's really speaking to me. But my question is about status. Does it change depending on which generation we're talking to and which industry we are approaching? And I'm asking this because for women, for example, in the banking industry, who made it 30 years ago, they were more about being a badass, not so much about being warm or likable, and that worked for them. But maybe now things are changing, and the newer generations would like take it in a different way. So should we change our status depending on who the audience is?
Yes, that's a great question. So the answer is, from a scientific perspective, the human brain has not evolved in any particular, you know, in any appreciable way since, you know, in 40 years. So the answer to it is no. We value the same things we've always valued. We care about people who care about others. We care about people who are good at what they do. But how we signal those things could be very, very different according to generation, according to culture, industry. So I'll just give you an example. Texting, right? There are certain things that I would think you cannot say over text and be a warm, nice person, right?
Yes.
Texting is for telling people you need like milk on the way home, right? It's not for solving problems. But I see these memes, and I have these lovely, lovely teenagers. But the memes that just crack me up are the ones that say like, texting your teenager is like texting somebody who's about to break up with you, because you're like, I hope you have a wonderful day, and they're like, uh-huh. Anyway, so the point is that texting is a tool. You would say, hey, if you're doing this, I'm not going to see you as very warm. If you're trying to solve problems or, you know, navigate a relationship over text, you're not even going to pick up the phone and call me. That's just a cultural norm about how we signal warmth. Not that warmth isn't important, but for people who use a certain medium or do a certain thing, they're like, that's perfectly warm. I'll take academia as an example. People in academia, like, let's go into a research talk, and people will start yelling about things. Mm-hmm. And you, if you walked in, you'd think, what are they yelling about? One, I mean, there's nothing to yell about. And why are they doing that? And it's just a norm. And so in that context, you can do it without any threat to your warmth, even across genders. But in another context, you couldn't. So the underlying framework doesn't change, but the signals that we use to say, is this a capable person? Is this a warm person? Those signals can be very context dependent. And that's where knowing our environment would be really important for figuring out how do we show to our audience the thing that they use to judge, are we capable and are we caring?
It's funny, I gave a keynote, interactive keynote last week, and I was looking at the crowd, and I'm like, this is a young group. And like, oh yeah, no, almost everyone's under 30. And I, other than, you know, guest lecturing at a college class, that is not my audience. I had to work so much harder to get them on board. And I did,
yeah.
But it took a lot, and I realized like, oh yeah, like the older people in the audiences were nodding when I'd say I worked with Chris Farley. And then I don't think these people necessarily that meant something to them in the same way it did to others.
That's, yeah, right, exactly. So the idea of how do you build your status, I got sent back. I started teaching undergraduates when I first became a professor. I loved it so dearly. And then as you get older, they move you into older audiences. And then they had to bring me out of retirement back into undergrad. And I did it once, not long ago, terribly. And all my jokes failed. Because all my jokes were now things like parent humor or workplace humor that are fun if those are your environments. But if you're not, they were like, what are you talking about? It was not good. So, yeah, that's the kind of thing of context dependent. Knowing your environment, it changes for sure.
All right. Other question?
Hi. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's interesting, I think, as women navigating right power and status and what that looks like. And so often in work environments, I feel like as women, we fight against each other. So trying to be a likable badass, like what advice do you have for women to, one, be a likable badass so that you can get power, maybe get status given to you to be successful? But how do you navigate that with other women in the room so that we lean into each other and support each other, which I have found does not often happen, unfortunately.
Okay, so this is not a plug for my free newsletter, but just as chance would have it, I do have a newsletter on Substack called The Upper Hand, and I swear we have not met, right? I can't make this up. That was my post today in my newsletter, was why women don't support other women more and what we can do about it. And I was struck by that many of you probably tuned into the Olympics and the Jordan Biles, or the Jordan Chiles and the Simone Biles bowing. To Rebecca Andrade. I just thought that was a nice visual of women supporting women. And so here's what I talked about in this post that I made today, which is, why does that happen? Well, one of my favorite papers in all of status research was done by a former grad school colleague of mine, and the title is very telling. And the title is, When the Boss Feels Inadequate. And the gist of the research is, when people have power, but they are insecure about their status. They're insecure about whether they're seen as competent and whether people value them. The way they behave is they act very aggressively and they lash out. And that's the finding. And so I said, if you understand that finding, you can understand why women don't do a better job of supporting other women. Because women have been made to feel insecure about their competence and their status since the beginning of time. And you can't really blame somebody when they actually do. And even though the reason they feel secure has nothing to do with you, because you weren't even there when that happened, I said we've like forced women to starve, thrown them a morsel of food, and then got really frustrated when they don't share it. And so that, I think, is the science of why it happens, is people are insecure about, do people value me? And when we feel insecure, and I can see these things happening as a psychologist, I can see them happening in myself. When you feel insecure, you're like, I'm not my best to other people because I'm fighting to try to claim and reclaim what any bit of respect I can gain and salvage. And so I always, and I just got a call, this is what prompted me to write it. I got a call from a woman who said, this is my problem at work. And I said, I'm going to tell you what to do and you're not going to like it. And I'm going to tell you the same thing and you're not going to like it, but I stand by it. And that is, you have to respect the hell out of them. You have to lean in, not away, because when someone is like this and they're territorial and they're aggressive and they're doing all the wrong things, what do? You reciprocate. And you're like, I'm going to do that to you, except I'll do it one better because I'm smarter. And then you start to do it. And then all it does is justify their paranoia to begin with. I knew there was a reason I was supposed to be insecure, and it escalates. And so the way we make insecure power holders act better is you make them feel secure. And so that doesn't feel very fun when you're in a situation where someone is not, like, they're not behaving the way you want them to behave, but the more you can make them feel secure, the more they will be benevolent. And I said, there's a reason that Jordan and Simone were so graciously able to bow, is because they're not insecure about their standing, right? They know that they're amazing, and that enables you to be gracious. And those people that you encounter in your career that aren't fighting for anything anymore, and they feel really respected, and they just are nothing but benevolent. And so if we can just be the start and say, I am going to make you feel secure that you are valued by me at least, that's going to be reciprocated as well. So no, I mean, again, when you're in the moment, no one likes it, but if you look at the science, that's what we need to do. It's like lean into those people, not away from them.
This is such an improv thing. Because, so when we hold auditions at Second City, or I'll say in the old days when I used to run the auditions and oversee them, we'd see maybe, 800 to 1,000 people because they were open to everyone. So occasionally you'd get someone who was out of their mind, all right? And that would happen. And then what we would always do is pair that person when they had to do a two-person scene with the absolute best person because they would make it work because they knew their job was to justify everything this person said, make them feel comfortable, and at least the scene would work. Whereas in a lesser improviser's hand, they would just get upset. And so great improvisers can kind of make anything work because they see everything as a gift. And that is a mindset that we do not walk around with as human beings. We just don't. And if you can develop that mindset, that to me is the key to all the successful people that I work with, which is like, I'm just going to see this as a gift, and that opportunity. But they don't do that. They practice that throughout their entire life, has been my experience. I think we got time for one more question.
So I really like the status and power framework. I think I hadn't really thought about it that way, but it's a great way to almost like measure yourself in your setting. But how do you then balance that with like mindfulness, right? Because if I'm aware of my status, aware of my power, that's me with awareness of your thoughts, of my peers' thoughts. But how do you balance that with the effort to just turn all that off, turn the anxiety off, and just be mindful of me?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the way I think about it is thinking about the purpose in any given interaction. And so there are some interactions where the purpose is to be able to be influential, to be able to achieve a goal, to be able to essentially invest in my reputation in a way that I would be able to use later as a resource. So if we do have those goals, right, then thinking about our audience, if I'm selling you something, then that's not the time to be mindful, right, of going inward, right? It's the time to think about, what do you care about and how am I going to address that? But I think there are other moments where that's not the goal. So I think those things can coexist. And I think about this is I
think about things like meeting more people, for example, I talk about this, is people can't be other promoters for you if they don't know you exist. I am a talkative introvert. I don't really like meeting people. And so there are times when knowing that that's what I'm supposed to do will force me out of my comfort zone to do it. And there are times when I get on the plane with both a hoodie and a blanket so I can put both over my head and I'm not going to actually talk to anybody. And so that's how I start to think about it, is what's the purpose of this particular moment and how critical is it for me to be thinking about my audience? And there's absolutely nothing wrong with turning inward and turning away from our audience, but to do it with conscious intention. I think, and that's one of the things I'm a big believer in, is I always say I'm really agnostic about what people should do as long as they turn habits into choices through some conscious awareness, and then you pick it and then you own it.
Ladies and gentlemen, Allison Fragale.
Getting BSN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.